It's just a,
it's just not as fun. So
this is Solidarity Journal. Share in a common voice. Just might find your own.
To think that this was John Doe.
It's like the argument about the arguments in part. No, we fought an entire goddamn war. States' right to do what?
Thanks for tuning in to Solidarity Journal today. It's Tuesday, June 21st. A lot of things have gone on in the news. This is just a slice. These are your headlines. Today we'll talk about voter reform, what it is and what it should be. In Peoria, there's a new sustainability commission led by Peoria City Manager Patrick Urich. We'll give you details on that. And I spoke with Larry Jones and Ross Clymer earlier this week. Don't miss our conversation. We talked about progressive organization and some ill effects that we've experienced from the Democratic Party, some of their shortcomings, and some progressive solutions to them. So stay tuned for this week's edition of Solidarity Journal. Keep that dial on 90.7 WAZU. More news is next. Republican attempts at voter reform. As the U.S. population grows and the number of eligible voters continues to climb with each election cycle, a disturbing trend of limiting voter access to the polls is taking place. With 2012 on the horizon, states are already gearing up to ensure that barriers are installed across the voting process, from restrictions on voter registration to strict requirements at the polls. It's been called the largest legislative effort to scale back voting rights in a century. Legislators justify the vast majority of this legislation by claiming they are merely attempting to prevent widespread voter fraud. The Brennan Center for Justice conducted the most extensive analysis of voter fraud allegations and concluded that proponents of voter ID laws could not find a proven example of a single vote cast at the polls in someone else's name that could be stopped by a poll site photo ID rule. Combating voter fraud is a red herring. It doesn't take more than a passing glance at the 2008 results map to understand why Republicans have been working so diligently to decrease the vote, especially in states where President Obama won by a slim margin. For the most part, the recent changes represent a dismal outlook for voting rights advocates. Republican succession at the state level has empowered the GOP with the ability to craft and adopt even the most restrictive election laws, while voting rights groups and others are taking many of these fights to the courts. There's no denying that enforcing these unduly restrictive laws is a cornerstone of the Republican 2012 strategy. That being said, while most of these changes have been pursued by largely Republican legislatures, they have not been able to be passed in some areas without the help of Democratic representatives. The changes vary from ballot access to voter registration and more, but most fall into three broad categories. Papers, please, voter ID, and proof of citizenship requirements. Banishing same-day registration, and an all-out assault on American voters. Survey after survey confirms the fact that millions of Americans between 6% and 11% do not have a government-issued photo ID. As many as 7% of United States citizens, 13 million individuals, do not have ready access to citizenship documents. The survey also found that as many as 32 million voting-age women may have available only proof of citizenship documents that do not reflect their current name, and that citizens with low incomes are more likely not to have ready access to their citizenship documents. Those startling numbers haven't stopped state legislators from adopting voter ID laws or pursuing proof of citizenship requirements for voter registration. According to Election Protection, proposed legislation that would require voters to produce photo identification at the polls is popping up in roughly half of the states across the country. Election Protection is a watchdog interest group that keeps tabs on voting access. In the past few months alone, Tennessee, Maine, Missouri, South Carolina, Texas, and Wisconsin have already signed into law or have passed laws that require voter ID. Similar laws are pending in Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, North Carolina, and Ohio. In Minnesota, Governor Dayton, a Democrat, vetoed a restrictive voter ID law, and Governor Schweitzer, a Democrat, did the same in Montana recently. Proof of citizenship for voter registration was part of the draconian Arizona law that made headlines last year. A court overturned that requirement. However, Alabama adopted a similar approach in a law. With the United States Supreme Court upholding Indiana's restrictive voter ID law, it was only a matter of time before legislatures from coast to coast followed the state's lead. The landscape on voter ID has changed. The facts, however, have not. Out of almost 400 million votes cast in general elections alone since 2000, the briefs cite one attempt at impersonation. That was one attempt out of 400 million votes cast of fraud. That attempt was thwarted upon a voter ID requirement, and 9 unresolved cases where impersonation fraud at the polls was suspected but not proven. 9 possible examples out of hundreds of millions, and these 9 cases might just as well have been due to clerical error. Not one of these cited reports occurred in Indiana, where restrictive voter ID laws are up in the legislature. While Republicans are clamoring to the fact that fraud is rampant, statistics and studies show that fraud is not rampant. In my opinion, they're legislating to restrict voter access by the poor and those who would normally vote Democrat, and it's happening all over the country. In Ohio, voting early on Sundays is on the chopping block, and absentee voting also looks to be shaved down in Wisconsin. Governor Walker signed a bill that drastically cut back in early voting periods, and Governor Scott in Florida did the same. Meanwhile, the North Carolina House recently passed a bill cutting its early voting period in half. Election day registration has proven to be a significant boost to voter participation in the states that have adopted it. In those states, average turnout rates are 10 to 12% above higher than national averages, showing the strength of EDR's ability to lower barriers to voter participation. Election day registration is when a voter can come on election day, register to vote, and vote. Not every state has this policy, but the states that do are being under attack by Republican legislators. The whirlwind of election reforms has taken place in some 13 states in 8 weeks alone. The New York Times penned an editorial. "They want to make voting harder," claims the New York Times, when trying to explain the mad dash to append election laws before the 2012 election. With the GOP presidential field being as bizarre and chaotic as it is, Republicans are well aware that they do not have a leader yet to market Republican ideas to the American people. They also know that they need an excellent marketer, a miracle worker. Some might say, since the American people don't agree with those ideas, the latest polls even show Americans agree with Democrats on gay marriage alone, with other issues such as climate change, tax policy, and more. Since Republicans can't change the progressive-leaning policy positions of Americans, they're changing the rules so that fewer Americans have the chance to express those positions at the polls. It's disgusting. It's outrageous. And absent voter education and lawsuits, there's little Democrats and voting rights advocates can do about it before the 2012 election. Let this tide of anti-voter reforms remind us all that while national politics may be flashier than state politics, the composition of our state legislatures and the party affiliation of our governors who wield the veto pens should be of paramount importance to us all. On June 6, 2011, the meeting of the Peoria Sustainable Commission, the featured speaker was Patrick Urich, or Urich, however it's pronounced. The new Peoria City Manager, Mr. Urich, has plans for the Peoria Sustainability Commission, and he laid them out for the 10 or so people who attended this meeting. City Manager Urich's title was restructuring the Peoria Sustainability Commission. He explained that he wanted to expand sustainability to the entire working city system, that this commission should not be about only environmental sustainability, but about the triple bottom line. The triple bottom line is social, environmental, and economic. He wants to change the commission to focus on fiscal sustainability. New city manager Urich's goal for the city of Peoria included smart population growth, financially sound city government, encouragement of growing business, responsive, efficient city organization, and an alive downtown warehouse district, multi-use, multi-function. Mr. Urich believes the new realities facing Peoria include becoming financially self-sufficient, able to face increased service demands, and that Peoria must refocus its mission, responsibilities, and services. He believes we need to pay special attention to core services for Peoria citizens. Mr. Urich has outlined the future tasks for the Sustainability Commission as follows. Restructure the commission and propose an action plan. Community outreach programs, civic, schools, faith-based, etc. Establish social, economic, and environmental baselines and metrics. Establish short and long-term strategies and action plans. Report, educate, and implement. Adjust commission, strategies, and action plan. Seek grants and establish the Peoria Sustainability Center. Mr. Urich's commission will establish 4 working groups: environment, transportation, development, and social. The 4 groups will be led by members of the Sustainability Commission, and the groups will work coherently with the Commission's 2009 report. Each sustainability group will have 4 areas of focus: policies, codes and standards, incentives, resources and grants, metrics and economics, education, awareness, and branding. This new commission will initially be led by city staff with the goal of developing meaningful deliverability across all facets of sustainability areas, the triple bottom line, social, environmental, and economic. Mr. Urich intends to develop the commission groups and identify key staff for focus areas in the near future. This report was written by Kirsten Sheets of the Peoria Families Against Toxic Waste. I know her interest group will keep their ears to the grindstone on new developments from the Peoria Sustainability Commission and our local city government, as will Solidarity Journal. These new developments in the Peoria city government are pretty astounding, and I look forward to seeing how they grow and what they can blossom into becoming. I know with community involvement in local government, we can make a more sustainable city. So stay tuned to Solidarity Journal, WAZU, for upcoming information about the Peoria Sustainability Commission. And we thank Kristen Sheets from the Peoria Families Against Toxic Waste for delivering this report on the events of the commission meeting. Stay tuned. You don't want to miss my conversation with Larry Jones and Ross Clymer on the withering away of the progressive movement in the Democratic Party and the hopeful growth of a third party and more. Stay tuned. Well, thanks for tuning in to Solidarity Journal on 90.7 WAZU. I'm pleased to introduce 2 guests in the studio today, Larry Jones and Ross Clymer. Ross Clymer, as you might know, is from the ICC Democratic Club here on campus. And Larry Jones, you're with a few interest groups locally.
Yeah, I've been going to meetings and some events for the Peoria Area Peace Network. I'd like to get more involved with them. It's a really good group, and I like what they're doing. And it's turning out that there's a Drinking Liberally chapter, and sometimes we can go into all about what Drinking Liberally is, but it's a group of liberals, socialists, progressives that just get together socially, Kelleher's Tavern every other Tuesday. It seems that some political activity is growing out of that, spinning off from it.
Yeah. Well, what kind of political activity is spinning off?
Well, it's in very, very early stages, and there's really nothing to announce yet, but a few of us, including yourself, Zach,
yeah,
and Mike Perillo of the Peace Network, and a few other people, we've been invited to attend a meeting next Wednesday, the 22nd. I guess that'd be tomorrow when this is aired, at the Lakeview Library. And it's just an attempt to figure out how to organize, a broad spectrum progressive network for Central Illinois. And I don't really have much more to say about that because it's really in, we're not even at the whiteboard stage. We're going to need to brainstorm and figure out, what common ground we have and what sort of strategy we would have for organizing and what we want to do and how we want to influence electoral politics, all those sorts of things.
There's a plethora of progressive groups.
There are, yes.
In Peoria.
Yeah. It's kind of surprising because, Peoria has been represented in Congress, for example, by Republicans for so long. And so we're in the heartland of Illinois where they grow a lot of corn and soybean and sow bellies and you think of Central Illinois, you think people are generally sort of conservative. But Peoria and Bloomington and Normal too, really, they have there's a lot of people that have a different way of looking at things. They're more progressive and want to make the world a better place.
Definitely. All right, Ross, you've done a lot of work with the Central Illinois Democratic Party, haven't you?
Yes, I have, actually. I've, for the past, 5 years, I've been pretty active within the Democratic Party as far as campaign work and stuff like that. I've always been pretty much a Democrat, but just actively for the past 5 years.
Well, what do you think about a potential, a third party or, the growth of a different ideology within the Democratic Party locally?
Well, locally, number-wise, there's a huge amount of swing voters who just, politics still in Illinois is pretty much, or politics in Central Illinois is still kind of like, well, I like the way that person dressed or the way that they talked or just the way that they listened to me. It's not kind of like Chicago where Chicago's more like, well, what can this person do for me or how can I get something out of it? But Central Illinois is still kind of that very, I can't even find words to describe Central Illinois. It's still kind of, it hasn't been quite corrupted. And as far as politics, it's, who knows? There could be a possibility if the third party groups could get their stuff together and be able to maybe grab enough swing votes to win a majority, but I mean, I'd have to see a candidate that would be really, really dynamic.
Yeah. So, Larry, you have a pretty rich history, don't you?
Well, I'm 63, almost 64 years old, so I guess, like most human beings, I've seen a lot in 64 years, I guess.
Well, such as?
Well, I was born in Chicago in 1947. It's almost a Paul Butterfield song.
I don't know what that means.
Oh, on one of the Paul Butterfield Blues Band albums, there's a song, Born in Chicago, 1941. But anyway.
Close.
Yeah. Look it up, Paul Butterfield fans. Anyway, yeah. I grew up in different neighborhoods because my family moved a lot. My dad was in construction and my mom worked at Sears and went to Austin High School. And for whatever reason, I was sort of like a conservative kid. I mean, right wing, kind of. I mean, I got into Ayn Rand as a teenager.
Oh, really?
Which I think is an appropriate age for Ayn Rand fans. Because it's pretty adolescent literature. But, anyway.
That's twisted, actually, knowing you. I do a little bit. It's kind of strange to hear that you read that.
Well, yeah. but there was a road to Damascus for me. Because when I was 19, I was drafted into the Army. This was 1966, and they were really escalating in Vietnam, and they were drafting everybody they could, and I got caught up in the net. Partly my own fault. I didn't register for the right courses, and I wasn't able to keep my college deferment, and so I got caught up in it. Oh. And after 8 months, I'd seen what, first of all, the war was doing to the people that managed to come back. If you didn't come back in a body bag, there was definitely something wrong.
You came back messed up.
Messed up, yeah. Definitely. And I began to hear stories about how the war was being fought, and you might have to shoot little kids because they could be holding a hand grenade, things like that. We've heard all the stories, and I'm not one of those that blames the people that went over there, because they didn't make the decision. It was, whoever was running things in Washington and mm-hmm. the military-industrial complex and all those wonderful people that drove us over there. So anyway, after 8 months of that, I found out that there are a lot of guys going to Canada, maybe Sweden, but mostly Canada. Both draft evaders and people like me, deserters. And so that's how I ended up in Canada. And I met some really good people when I went to Toronto, because there was a really active anti-war movement there, and they were helping guys like me get across the border and get established and find jobs, and I'm always grateful. I'll always be grateful to all those people that helped me.
Wow. So you got into Canada, and it wasn't all that welcoming to newcomers?
Oh, it was, yeah. Really. I had no problems getting by, I was a kid. I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah, and you were 19.
19. Almost 20 by the time I got to Toronto.
Wow. You just, your family, they didn't contact you and anything like that?
Well, I sort of had to not tell them I was going.
So they thought you were...
I told my brother, actually. My brother, who's oldest, closest to me in age. But he was the only person who knew.
Wow. What did you do when you were up there? You 19, you were roughly 20 years old. I guess you got a job.
I got
a house.
I got a lot of jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was 1967, Summer of Love, so I did Summer of Love stuff.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Worked at the Toronto General Hospital as a research assistant, and did some acting.
Wow. A lot of actors come out of Canada.
yeah. I didn't keep up with it, though,
yeah,
as a profession. But eventually, yeah, I settled down and got married and a couple of times, actually.
So what'd you do politically in Canada?
Well, nothing for a long time, except I went to the odd demonstration and signed petitions and things like that. I remember that when Nixon invaded Cambodia, just after the May 4th, and there was something called the May 4th movement. May 4th is the day of the massacre at Kent State.
Oh, yeah.
So there were big demonstrations in Toronto just after that, too, about both Cambodia and the way people, students, protesters were getting shot.
In the States?
Yeah. I mean, it was Canadians who were sympathetic to the anti-war movement and were part of the worldwide anti-war movement. And, there were plenty of Americans in Toronto by that time, too.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I went with my first wife to that demonstration. But she was almost 9 months pregnant. We had to leave before the horses went crazy.
These are mounted horsemen?
Yes, mounted policemen in front of the U.S. consulate.
That must have been a powerful time.
It was, yeah. It really was. It was a very confusing time, because even in Canada, you sort of didn't know what was going to happen next.
Yeah.
Kind of like now. this is a crazy time, too, in a different way.
Yeah, it is.
but we're still involved in foreign wars, constantly now. And because there's no draft, of course, it makes it sort of easier to just send people over, whether they're in the regular forces or the National Guard, and you know, you don't see too many gigantic demonstrations anymore.
Yeah.
But it's odd because, what is it, 60, 70%, I don't know what the polls are, but a vast majority of Americans are opposed to the war in Afghanistan and mm-hmm. never did see a reason. Well, they finally saw that there was no reason to go to Iraq.
Yeah.
And now Libya, it's another confusion, and there's a secret war in Yemen and
Pakistan. You
know, yeah. Yeah. What's going on there? And what's next?
Right.
And there's no draft, so college kids aren't being sent to certain death or disfigurement or whatever, but it's hard enough on the people that are in the forces. I'm sure we all have relatives or friends that are part of it, and they're paying a big price for governmental and corporate stupidity.
Yeah. Ross, what do you have to say about our government's involvement in wars around the world?
Well, personally, I just believe that, there is no such thing as necessary war. So, it took me a few years after 2003. I mean, for a few years, I pulled the party line, the whole, we have to be in these wars. And it took me until, I think, about 2005 to kind of, wake up and realize, hey, this is utter nonsense that they're feeding us. I mean, it took me, a combination of, musical artists, comedians, and actual friends to show me the actual light for what was going on politically and what was going on in the war, which actually kind of led me to my later involvement in politics, because I decided to, instead of going into the military, I thought to myself, well, there's a better way. You can solve things through politics and through working with other countries instead of having to resort to weapons. I mean, I believe Professor Feifel here on campus always says war should be the last option in politics.
Yeah, very true. So when was it that you started getting involved in the organized politics in Canada?
Well, I guess when I was finishing university, when I was just about to get my Bachelor of Education degree, I was living in Toronto again after being in BC and Montreal for a while. But there was a federal by-election, a sort of a special election in the riding or district where I lived, and I joined the NDP, the New Democratic Party. I'd been thinking about that for a long time. And
what makes them different from Canada's old Democratic Party, or the one that was this was bore out of?
The two traditional parties in Canada are the Conservatives and the Liberals. But there are other parties too. It's easier to form a party and get somebody elected, either at the provincial or federal level. Back in the 20s and 30s, times were hard for people in various parts of Canada, especially in the West. Parts of some of the provinces didn't even have electricity. So a couple of movements were formed, and one was the Commonwealth Cooperative Federation, which was the beginning of the sort of like the organized left or center left in Canada. That was about 1935 or so. And then eventually in the 1940s, the CCF formed the provincial government in Saskatchewan with Tommy Douglas as the premier. He's the grandfather of Kiefer Sutherland, by the way.
An American actor.
Yeah. But Tommy Douglas and the CCF, they had this idea that there should be socialized medicine, that nobody should, have to. Everybody should be able to get medical care if they need it.
Mm-hmm.
It took 20 years to bring that to Saskatchewan, but in the 1960s they did. And guess what? The doctors and the insurance companies, they all fought against it because it was evil socialism. But a couple of years later, it was adopted by the Liberal Party in Canada. And now there's a nationwide Medicare system. They call it, that's what they call Medicare up there.
Yeah.
Someday we'll have Medicare for all down here.
Medicare for all.
Not yet. But by the way, because of Canada's socialized health insurance and health care system, they spend maybe two-thirds of what we spend per capita on health care.
In your best opinion or your best judgment, how much do you think we spend? We don't have any polls in front of us or any real data, but what do you say? What is two-thirds of what we spend?
Well, I don't remember the figures. I haven't looked at them for a while. But I think the last time I looked, it was something like $15,000 per capita in the U.S. versus $8,000 or $9,000 in Canada. And it's even lower in other countries like Britain, France,
yeah,
Holland, the Scandinavian countries.
Yeah.
And they all have something. Even Germany has a complete, everybody's covered. It's private insurance companies, but they're really highly regulated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now all these countries have issues and problems with their healthcare systems, but
so do we?
Yes, we do. But everybody in those countries is covered. Nobody goes bankrupt because they have to have an operation. And that happens
right.
A lot here.
Yeah, it's a terrible thing. So what exactly did you do with the New Democratic Party? You ran a re-election campaign, or petitioned your neighbors? Or
well, for a few years, I just volunteered. I was a pretty good canvasser. I would go from door to door and find out what people thought and what their issues were. I mean, during election campaigns, and then I would sort of try to get them to say who they were going to vote for, how they were going to vote.
Oh, at the door.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the process is you find out who your supporters are and you make sure they vote.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Sounds simple,
Yeah, Ross, you've done a lot of that around here, haven't you? Talk about that a bit.
For Central Illinois, not a lot of people want to share that information. Most of them would just say, I'm voting Democrat or I'm voting Republican, but that doesn't tell you if they're voting for your guy or gal. Sometimes I used to work for several politicians who, we would hit areas that were traditionally not liberal friendly, but we were always kind of wondering if maybe our message and what we were going to try and do, whether it's a state and federal, was reaching over to the other side. So we'd have to go into traditionally Republican neighborhoods, and those were always you always walked away with a story in that neighborhood, whether it was somebody waving a gun or going to call the cops, or to a person who actually says, you know what, I will vote for your person because of such and such reason. I mean. So, and I encourage anybody who wants to get politically involved to go out and canvass, because that's you actually making a difference. And the ICC Democrats, of course, will be doing that later on this election, if I have to put in my own little plug for the ICC Dems.
Yeah, sure, that's no problem.
I know it's a little cheap, but yeah.
No,
we,
no. Every good politician would be that cheap.
But no, we... the ICC Dems do a lot of canvassing work for politicians, whether it's petition season or just whether it's actually going and knocking door to door. It's great exercise, too.
And the goal would be to someday canvass for a progressive party in America, in Central Illinois.
Absolutely, yes. And if that's, the Democratic Party, great.
Yeah.
If it's something like the Working Family Party that they have in some states, okay. If it's the
Green Party.
Yeah. I think, getting back to the CCF and the NDP, it took 75 years in 1961, the CCF made a coalition with the Canadian Federation of Labor and formed the new party. It's called the New Democratic Party now.
Because it was focused more on labor.
Yes, more on labor than it had been, and with a more formal alliance between labor and the party. Sort of like what the Democrats used to have with labor, mm-hmm. which they seem to be losing now,
yeah.
which is really unfortunate.
Very.
For them and for labor.
What are some of the differences between our styles of government? What style of government does Canada have that has led to an ease of, you know, alliances like that or creating new parties? And what kind of roadblocks do we have in our style of government?
The rules are different in every state, but it's much harder to get a party on the ballot.
Here in the States.
Yeah, certainly here in Illinois. I mean, the Green Party, they were lucky to get a 10% vote in, what was it, 2006, which was largely a protest vote against Blagojevich.
Blagojevich?
Yes, if I recall. I mean, I think. That's my analysis, is that the Green Party ran a good campaign, and they benefited from a lot of dissatisfaction with Blagojevich.
Statewide?
Yeah, statewide.
State, for state offices?
Yes, and so their candidate for governor, Rich Whitney, he got 10%, so that meant that the next election, the Green Party could be on the ballot. But otherwise, you have to go through all sorts of hoops and do all sorts of petitioning.
Oh, yeah.
But in Canada, there are provincial parties and federal parties, and it's much easier to register a party and have it recognized and offer tax credits for donations, which makes a big difference.
And provincial, you mean like what we would call a state?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. Like Ontario is a province. That's where I ran for the provincial legislature in 1990.
Oh, really?
Got 30%, came in second. It was a big improvement for the NDP.
Were you given a seat in the legislature?
No. The Liberal candidate got 40%.
Oh, I see.
And the Conservatives got like 18 or 20. And the Christian Heritage Party got a couple of percent, and the Greens got a few votes. And, you know, there were like six parties on the ballot, which is typical.
Yeah, they have a lot more representation because they have people, and they realize they need to represent them truly. Down here, it's just like two parties. Hey, pick.
Yeah.
Pick and which one you think best represents you.
And unfortunately, you know, the Democrats are becoming more like the Republicans, or at least more like the Republicans used to be. The Republicans are becoming more like, a party of the Confederacy.
It's a little loony.
Yeah.
One's moved further right, and then Democrats have had to follow.
Well, they have followed, whether they had to or not.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's been a mistake because let the Republicans isolate themselves. I mean, the Democrats should be fighting for progressive issues. They should be fighting like heck for a single-payer health care system, for example. And they should be fighting to make it easier for people to organize unions and to join unions and be represented. But, you know, that was one of the promises that Obama broke, or the Democrats broke. There was going to be a card check system where it was easier to get certified as a union in a workplace without the bosses or organizing fake elections. But we can't do that.
Yeah, there's been a lot of empty promises from the Democrats for a long time.
Yes.
In a lot of areas.
I'm afraid so, yeah.
It's almost as if in order for anything to get done in America, there has to be a pseudo-competition, because in reality, both of the parties are the same.
Yes.
Because there's never any coalition building. There's never really any bipartisan efforts.
It's nationwide, you can say that, but I think to give the Democrats their due, there are some good pockets of progressive organizing.
Yeah, isn't in the Congress there's a progressive caucus?
Yeah, there's the Congressional Progressive Caucus.
How many members of Congress are in that?
64, 63 in the House and Bernie Sanders in the Senate, who's not even a Democrat.
Oh, there's a Republican who's...
No, he's not a Republican.
Independent.
Yes, he was the mayor of Burlington, ran as a socialist.
Wow.
And Vermont is right next to Canada. You know?
Oh, yeah. Vermont is the place to be. It's the liberal headquarters of America. You got anything to offer here, Ross?
Oh, where to begin? the Democratic Party, there are some pluses and minuses, just as for the Republican Party, which there's a lot more minuses lately for the Republican Party, I have to say. I think it depends on candidates, honestly. It's not about the whole, you can't blame the whole thing on everybody. You know, you can't, it's kind of like blaming Germany for being horrible back in World War II. Yeah, there was a ton of horrible people back in Germany, but there was also, you have to remember, those pockets of freedom fighters during Hitler's reign. It's not as severe over here. I mean, for the Democratic Party, it's the candidates. There's some people who are just, they got into power because they were able to kind of sell out the Democratic Party and its ideas. But there are, unfortunately, I have to mention one guy, Anthony Weiner, now the disgraced former congressman. Before he was disgraced, he was actually a very hardcore Democrat who stuck to his guns. Unfortunately, he's, you know, now disgraced and stepped down, but some of the things that he passed were very, very progressive, even for New York, from everything from windmills to the 9/11 healthcare system for the victims. It took them 10 years pretty much for them to actually decide in Congress to start taking care of the victims and the people who rushed in on that horrible day. And Anthony Weiner was a very powerful voice in Congress for those victims. At one point, he actually started to really chew out the Republican Party for, you know, stalling and trying to nickel and dime the program. So, I mean, it's too bad that kind of stuff happened to him. But, I mean, there's a great, you know, that's a great example of a person who really stuck to the Democratic ideas of, you know, for the workers' rights and for the little guy.
All right.
I have to disagree with Ross on one thing. When you say it depends on the candidates, yeah, you find good candidates and they'll fight for your values. But I think what has to happen is that progressives have to organize, and they have to find their candidates, and they have to run the campaigns in a progressive way and make sure that candidate, when he's elected or she's elected, is going to be true to the values that they were elected on.
Yeah, you can't let candidates come to you and fool you into believing that they're going to represent you.
Right, yeah.
And all these kind of interests that progressives have sort of get taken advantage of. They say, we can adhere to all these things that you care about, and then while in office, they don't prove, they don't put their money where their mouth is.
Yeah, and a lot of that has to do with corporate money. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's hard to get elected without, you know, a good campaign war chest to pay for ads and not volunteers, but campaign staff and all sorts of things and get out the vote efforts. So, yeah, it's understandable that candidates are tempted to accept corporate donations, but it's a slippery slope and it's very dangerous.
Oh, yeah, what's up?
Well, I have to agree in some aspects. The Democratic, or not just the liberal side of the spectrum, us liberals have to actually stop being kind of this mass blob that every once in a while shows up to the to the voting booth. We actually have to organize ourselves. And yeah, when it comes to candidates, we have to be careful about certain candidates, trying to portray themselves as this one view. We have to kind of let the candidates and the party know that, hey, we want our interests shown. That's why there are political parties in the first place, because people had certain interests that were extremely important to them, and hence the formation of political parties.
Well, do we have political parties? It seems like we just have two, right? So does that count? That's just like one.
Well, there's political parties. There's the Democrats, the Republicans, the Socialists, the New Party, the New Party of Illinois, which I'm still trying to figure out what they actually do. The Constitution Party, which is more conservative. I don't refer to them as the Tea Party, because to have a party, you must have structure. And the Tea Party is more of a movement. So I refer to them as the Tea Movement. You know, if you want a political party, you have to have somebody running the show, at least somebody at the reins trying to, you know, because if you look at the Tea Party as an example of when Sarah Palin came to Washington, Illinois, for her speaking engagement, there's Tea Party members protesting her and Tea Party members going in to her event as guests. Mm-hmm. So until that movement becomes more solidified, I'm going to continue to call it a movement and not a party.
I just wanted to say something about what Ross said, that the left within the Democratic Party has to organize and become act. That's true. Absolutely. Progressives have to stage a hostile takeover of the Democratic Party, district by district, county by county, state by state. Can't let the centrists and the conservatives run things anymore.
Oh, yes.
But it's going to take a long time. Going back to Canada, it took 75 years for the CCF and the NDP to become the second party in Canada. I mean, in the last election on May 2nd, the Liberals were really decimated. They went from, there are 308 seats in the federal parliament, in the House of Commons, and the Liberals went down from 88 or so to 34. The New Democrats, largely because of they swept Quebec, went from 36 to 103. And you know, it's never been at the federal level. The NDP has never been that powerful. They've had provincial governments in, well, BC, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, Nova Scotia, but never federally. And so this is a big step forward, and it's going to take a long time. Maybe not 75 years, but if progressives, the left. In the United States, in and out of the Democratic Party right now, if they want to achieve the same kind of success and eventually elect a real progressive president and a real progressive Congress, yes, it's going to take a while. And
So, what are some of these small steps for progressive organization, and why isn't what we have so far the 64? Congressmen and women of the Progressive Caucus, where do they fall short?
Interestingly, that's the largest organized caucus within the Democratic Party. The Blue Dogs are about half that big.
Well, let's tell our listeners what a caucus is.
Well, as I understand it, within Congress, within the party conferences, you know, members can organize themselves into a caucus which has a principles, goals. If you went to the Congressional Progressive Caucus website, you could see their sort of like platform. Mm-hmm. By the way, they have developed a people's budget, an alternative to the budget that the Republicans passed.
And probably alternative to the Democrats' proposals, correct?
Well, I don't think the Democrats as a whole have proposed a budget, right? But the Republicans, because they run the House and budgets have to come from the lower house, the House of Representatives, mm-hmm. The Republicans, they did pass a budget. That's the one with the Paul Ryan death to Medicare provision.
Oh, that didn't pass, though.
It did, yes. It did, yeah.
Thought that it didn't.
No, no, it hasn't passed the Senate yet, so it's not part of the budget.
Thank God.
And it won't be. But
it passed the House.
It did pass the House, yeah. I mean, but the Republicans have passed all sorts of things in the House. They've repealed health care, you know. Mm-hmm. The Affordable Care Act. Hmm. But, you know, that's not going to become law either, unless the Republicans win the Senate and the White House. And even then, I predict that they won't get rid of all of the Affordable Care Act.
So, again, How do we as progressives organize to create this movement? Does it have to be a movement or can it be a party? We heard Ross explain what movements and parties are. So
I agree with that definition. I think it has to be both. You have to have a movement and you have to, to have electoral success, to have an influence on elections, you have to have some sort of party. And again, my proposal is that progressives organize, find each other first, figure out what it is they want to achieve, figure out how to achieve it, and get to work.
Mm-hmm. Well, organizing progressives
yeah.
around our area, there are many. Global Warming Solutions Group, Peoria Families Against Toxic Waste, people at the Global Village, the Fair Trade Shop in Peoria
right.
Heights, Drinking Liberally and all of its members, Peoria Area Peace Network, the Green Party of Illinois, locally, people who you might find at the farmers markets, either downtown or in the Metro Center. Any help?
ACLU.
ACLU. Ross, what do you got?
There's also the Action Now group that I know both of Bloomington and Peoria. Oddly enough, everybody forgets about these kind of groups, but there's the musical groups, especially the, and I know it's kind of shocking, the punks. There is a fairly large number of punk kids, and the ones that I've talked to are more liberal than even the Green Party kids. I mean, they're for everyone, you know, they're not exactly hippies, but they're not exactly, you know, the kids that are going to be sitting down, lying down. They just haven't had a way of becoming politically active. That's why they listen to punk rock music. That's their way of becoming politically active. And I've actually been trying to recruit them heavily to get involved in politics, whether it's canvassers or just spreading the word about events.
Well, I think we should play some punk music when this interview is over.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Hey, I just want to throw in this. Speaking of politics and punks, two members of the Canadian House of Commons, Charlie Angus and Andrew Cash, were in a punk band in Toronto in the 80s called the Grievous Angels.
The Grievous Angels.
Yeah, so if you can dig them up sometime.
And how many of our elected officials have anything cool going on in their past? Anybody know?
There's a city alderman up in Chicago who was actually part of, he was a member of a punk band, and I'm trying to recall the name, and it would probably come to me after the interview, which
well,
is a shame.
All right. That's all right.
But he was actually, the only reason why Chicago punk didn't really take off music-wise as you know, for the punk movement, was because they really didn't have too many artists or contractors looking to sign many of their bands. But there was some really great bands back during the 70s and 80s for their Chicago punk. And I'm quite sure there's probably a few Chicago kids that are going to beat me up for not mentioning a few of the Chicago punk bands nowadays. So, I mean, there's still alive. It's still pretty good music.
Yeah, counterculture stuff in music and in art, it's always been a place to, you know, expand your horizons and sort of, you know, look past the society as it is established.
Yeah, there's a song that Utah Phillips sings called Bread and Roses. Yeah, we want the bread. We need to improve our material lives, but also we want to feed the spirit.
Oh, that's right.
And that's what culture and art is for.
Yeah, the relationship between mind, body, and soul. You've got to have it imbalanced.
Right.
Yeah. So, progressive organization locally. What do you know?
Not as much as I'd like to know, but maybe we'll know more in a week or so.
After tomorrow.
Yes, after tomorrow. We'll see what happens at this little organizing meeting, this little ad hoc group, and we'll go from there. And
Wednesday the 22nd at 7 o'clock at the Lakeview Branch
right.
Library,
yeah.
Peoria Public Library. Anybody who'd like to go and talk with progressive leaders of the small interest groups that exist around Peoria, by all means, attend.
Yes. We need all kinds of help.
Yeah.
All kinds of contributions. Like I said, it's gonna be a long, hard effort.
I'm gonna get a mailer out on that. I have a bunch of emails, you know, people's email accounts. I'm gonna get a mailer out, spread the word. There's still a few days left until then, so
right.
over the weekend.
It's not really Tuesday, is it?
Not really. It's actually what day is it? Friday.
Yeah.
Because we record. Solidarity Journal is recorded at WAZU Studios in East Peoria campus
Shh, it's
of
live.
ICC.
And for all those punks out there that are currently listening to, there is a punk rock show going to be going on at Castle Theater in Bloomington Normal. It's 8 to 10 bands. They're still trying to get a few more of them hooked on, but 8 to 10 bands for $10. It starts at 2 o'clock at Castle Theater and should run until either the building is burnt down or the show is over. So we'll figure out which will happen first.
Go ahead.
I have a website, a blog, slothropia.com, slothropia.com.
I couldn't write that down as fast as you wrote it. I don't think anybody else can either.
But I write about Canadian politics, American politics, and culture, and anything else that I think of.
Slothropia. Slothropia.
Yeah. It's sort of named after a character in Gravity's Rainbow.
.com?
Yeah.
Slothropia.
.com.
Awesome.
Excellent. Let's get organized because we're in a crisis. I mean, we don't have a lot of time. Some very bad things are developing. The wealthy and the corporations are grabbing more and more wealth and more power. And, you know, what we call capitalism is not sustainable.
That's right.
And we need to, as a species, if we want to survive, we're going to have to make some changes and learn how to live together and work together.
What do you think is a good alternative to capitalism?
Well, in the long run, I'd like to see, you know, the people that do the work make the decisions.
Yeah. Cooperative.
Yeah. And people have to, I mean, people live in communities, but they don't really see themselves as part of a community.
Yeah, especially in America.
Yes. It's like, oh no, just, you know, me and my little nuclear family and our little house.
And all my junk.
Yeah.
All my stuff.
And that's not real.
Mm-mm.
Because, you know, people are social animals and we need each other and we learn from each other.
We need community gardens and community yes. bonds and community events and
yeah.
a little more commune.
Yeah.
A tea.
Yes. Yeah, it's you know, I don't have a simple answer, an ideology to resolve every issue, but I do think, you know, we've gone way too far in concentrating wealth and power in a few hands.
Mm-hmm. Very true, Larry. Wise as always.
Oh, shucks.
Ross, you got any input?
Well, pretty much it starts with you, the listener. Right now you're kind of taking action right now by listening to this show, which I fully endorse. You know, keep. I know it's kind of cheap, but just
yeah, this
right
is a great
now,
show.
It's a stepping stone. If you want to be politically active, you can be politically active, whether it's you know, putting on a sticker on the back of your car saying no war or Obama or, you know, whatever sticker. I'm currently still, if anybody's out there that knows any stickers that say shut up Glenn Beck, please get a hold of Zach for me so I can get a hold of that sticker. But by getting politically active and by also education, educating the masses is something that's always been a big part of any movement is when you educate people about what politics is. A week ago, I was on a party bus in Bloomington at ISU during the graduation ceremonies talking with a girl who had no clue how to be politically active. And it was very surreal conversation as we're sitting there, you know, trading beers. But I told her how to get politically involved, which is a sad thing, is now that, you know, she's no longer going to the campus, she has to, you know, be politically involved in her local politics, you know, whether it's her hometown or her home state. Just get involved. It's pretty easy. You know, whether it's hear about a rally, go to a rally, hear about an event. There's always somebody, there's always, you know, either a Zach or a Ross out there at an event who are willing to educate you about what's going on politically or help you to educate others about politics.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's very sad. Earlier this year, I was sitting at the table organizing Democrats to come over and sign up for our organization, which we will be doing in the fall. I know, another shameless plug. But
yeah, fall semester at ICC. Ross and his ICC Democrats will be flourishing, hopefully.
We'll keep our fingers crossed. We're currently at 35 members, but I always want more. The more people we have, the better chance we can change the American way. But this girl came up, and she had no idea what... You know, I said to her, we're a political group, and she looked at me as if I had just spoken Greek to her. Mm-hmm. You know, just so...
Yeah, it's sad, really. People are so wrapped up in, like, the consumer-driven... Yeah. Ideas of freedom, what freedom is, you know, it's the ability to decide where to go shopping and blah, 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 all that BS that just clouds the truth and, you know, helps them win, really.
To quote a punk kid that I talked with, who currently owns a business, he says, I blame the parents. The reason why there's not a huge punk movement and why people aren't as involved in politics is because nobody has taught us kids, you know, the new generation, to be politically active. Nobody's bothered to ask us, what do you want? So I put it to you, the listener out there, what do you want in politics? Think about it, and then sit down and go, how the heck do I get this accomplished? Yeah, there we go. How do I get this accomplished? And you know what? Go out and do it, and hopefully I'll see you at a rally.
Right on.
If anybody has an event or an issue they want to publicize, I'd be happy to put it on either Slothropia.com or PeoriaProgressive.com, which is a sort of a new website.
Yeah.
Just getting started.
Yeah, that's a great website, both of you guys. I've seen the two blogs, the local progressive blogs. And yeah, definitely a good place to advertise progressive events.
Yeah.
Good way to connect and create that progressive organization.
Yeah, you just go to either of those websites and leave a comment and we'll respond.
All right. And as Ross was touching on rallies locally, every Saturday there's a rally at University in Maine, an anti-war rally put on by the Peoria Area Peace Network. It's a great time. It's a good way to meet people, like-minded people. Well, I think that about wraps it up. It was a great conversation. Tune in next time for Solidarity Journal. Same time, same place. Don't change your dial. 90.7 WAZU. Peoria's one and only Pacifica Radio affiliate and our community voice. When I live in a country without history, save myself, forget to save myself. One that buried its roots with its identity, save myself, forget to save myself. We still are searching for liberty, save myself, forget to save myself. We still are hiding from reality. Well, we are way out of time today. Please check out PeoriaProgressive.org, Slothropia.com. Keep your ears to the Peoria Sustainability Commission, led by our new city manager. And watch out for those anti-voter traps by the Republicans. Thanks for listening to WAZU. Stay tuned till next week. Peace and solidarity, Peoria.